podcast is a member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com.
This is Frank Menzer, and I officially approve the use of the Rules Cyclopedia.
Products of your imagination.
You burst through the door, you find a small room filled with golden jewels. And a red dragon.
Products of your imagination.
And a red dragon. And a red dragon.
Products
he
of
starts
your imagination.
Save or die!
Raise them up, raise them up. Zombies all around me, I be hacking them all up.
Products of your imagination.
Welcome to the Save or Die Podcast, a podcast about classical Dungeons & Dragons. If it's in a box, we'll talk about it.
Hi folks, this is DM Glenn. This week we're going to bring you a little something different. This is an interview I recently had with James R. Raggi IV, who is the author of Lamentations of the Flame Princess. We got to talk about how the game differs from Basic and how it's the same from Basic and, you know, artwork, production, all that kind of thing. So just sit back, relax, and we'll be back with the regular program next week. Thanks. It's DM Glenn. And I'm sitting down here with James Edward Raggi the fourth. I'm sorry.
Fourth.
Well, I got the important part right anyway. Raggi.
Yes.
The fourth. Author, creator of Lamentations of the Flame Princess, Weird Fantasy Role-Playing. I happen to have the Grindhouse edition here in my hands. And I've got to say, this thing looks gorgeous.
Thank you.
I mean, the production quality in this game, I was just kind of, when I got in the mail, I was just kind of blown away. You know, I open it up and I find dice and character sheets and these three nifty books with some great artwork in there. My God, it's beautiful. That's all I can say.
Thank you.
But we do have some questions for you.
Oh, goody. This would be a very short interview if you didn't.
That's true. How long have you been gaming?
How long have I been gaming? Well, it's either since my 8th or 9th birthday. I can't remember exactly which it was, but we're talking 1983, 1984 is when I started.
That's when I started. That's funny. And I was 23. Okay, all right, fine. I'm the old man of gaming. Okay. So you were gaming since 8 or 9, D&D at first?
Yes, Mensa Redbox.
Mensa Redbox. Good choice.
Yes.
Good choice. And so how did you get the idea for Lamentations of the Flame Princess? I know the OSR has been going on and people have been putting their own stuff out, but how did this come into your head?
Well, the idea for publishing to begin with, you know, it's just something I'd been doing for years and years with the metal zine that I'd been doing since 1998. You know, I love publishing. I, you know, love writing, love getting my stuff out and, you know, making waves, basically.
Oh, yeah.
So when the OSR came out in Osric, you know, when those things started setting the example, you know, I wanted to get in on this. You know, I'm a gamer. Hey, you know, I'm, you know, a lot more natural, I think, writing for gaming than I was ever writing about music because I'm not a musician. I can't participate in what I'm talking about.
Wow, then you become
gaming,
a critic.
Yes. That's exactly what I was. But, you know, it feels more natural, you know, writing gaming material because I'm a gamer. And
okay.
That always helps. I'm participating on every level in this thing, so
right.
I think what I write is more relevant to gaming than what I used to write in music had to do with the music. So
when you're hands-on like that, it's a lot easier to write about it.
Yeah, and you know my tastes just seem to be a bit more to the macabre and, you know, horror-oriented, heavy metal-oriented. So everything I've done just naturally has more of that flavor in it.
Got that edge on it.
Yeah, because all of the classic authors that everyone always, you know, rattles off, I didn't get into those until well after getting into gaming.
Mm-hmm.
So, So, you know, I hear the old timers, they talk about, oh, we all read the same books and, you know, traded the books and had that same background, so it was natural for the gaming. It was the other way around for me. So I guess that while a lot of these influences, or while a lot of this literature helps the game make more sense, you know, as I discovered it, you know, my heart isn't in, you know, making Conan into a role-playing game, making Lord of the Rings into a role-playing game, if that makes sense.
No, definitely it does. I mean, there's all sorts of takes on fantasy out there, and gaming, of course. Now, Lamentation of the Flame Princess, this, which I should say, flavor of D&D kind of gave you inspiration for this? What's it, I don't want to say what's it based on, but what was the base core you used? Was it like Metzer or Moldvay Cook or something like that?
Different parts were taken from different bits. For example, the spell lists, I think, were more inspired by advanced versions of the game just because there are far more spells, far more options there. You go to the basic versions of the game and the spell lists are, you know, 8 spells per level, and I always wanted more variety than that. But,
right.
For example, the tutorial, the format of the tutorial is basically taken straight out of Mentzer.
Okay.
And, yeah, as far as the any influence from Moldvay, that would have come through, you know, Labyrinth Lord open game content.
Right.
I rewrote, you know, almost all of the open game content that I used for my game, I rewrote. Didn't take a lot of it verbatim. But, of course, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel for every single... That's the point of the open game license.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some stuff that I found basic fantasy role-playing and Labyrinth Lord were, I think, most useful for me there, but... You know, Moldvay is another thing that, you know, starting with Mentzer, I didn't read the Moldvay basic and the Marsh Cook expert until, you know, just like 2 or 3 years ago. So,
right.
So those aren't huge influences either.
I can understand that. So what was the timeline between the idea to the rough draft to the finished draft to the finished product? How long would you say that took?
The box set.
Box set, I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's see, that would have been... I'd been thinking about doing my own game for a while. You know, I'd started off with the random esoteric creature generator, moved on to doing the adventures. But for the box set, I think that was towards the end of fall, beginning of winter 2009.
Okay.
That I had the idea, and that at first it was for commercial reasons, because I was doing these adventures and I was wanting to get them out there, but... Stores are really hesitant to take, you know, basically generic supplements for games they don't carry.
Right.
So I thought if I had my own brand, you know, my own brand, my own game, that would help, you know, get my entire line out there into distribution more. And once I made the decision to do that, you know, Labyrinth Lore is already out there in distribution.
Right.
Swords and Wizardry is already out there. Osric's already out there. You know, I love the basics of the game, so it makes no sense for me to just do something completely different and sever all ties, but at the same time, these things had already been done. And the flavor that I'd already been going for in my adventures, people were noting, this is not normal D&D. This is something a little bit different.
Oh, no.
So I just went with that, used that.
Okay. Just went out of my head there. did this product have any kind of, during the gestation period, did it change any way significantly from what you first came up with?
Well, the Grindhouse edition that you have is the second printing.
Right.
The first printing was a bit different, and of course, my tastes in how I game, it's constantly changing. I mean, it's not huge, the changes, but, you know, 6 months ago I was a little bit in a different place than I am now, and another 6 months I'll be in a little different place.
Right.
So, of course, things change. And, know, sometimes I'll have an idea that's right at the end of the production process, and to actually put that idea in there, you know, you're going to delay another 3-4 months. You're going to throw out work already done, and you know, in publishing, the one of the things you have to learn is at some point you got to put the project to bed.
Yeah.
You'll never get anything done if you don't ever decide that, okay, it's finished. You know, the ideas that are still coming will have to go into the next thing. And that's a little bit painful, but, but for example, some of the changes between the first deluxe edition and the Grindhouse edition, having to do with how the spell lists were moved around and things like that, I mean, that's an example of that evolution.
It was nice that you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have the idea that, you know, even though this is a game that's in many ways close, and hopefully the atmosphere and the changes make it its, you know, own unique thing, but it's still close in many ways to other games. It would be some sort of ideal to say that I should take 5 years to playtest it and get it perfect. But at the same time, even if I did that from the point I published it 5 years from now, the day after I publish it, I'm still going to have, oh, wait a second. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's tough.
How much playtesting did you do?
You know, the games that I've been playing the past few years before deciding to do my own game were Labyrinth, Lord, and Basic Fantasy Role-Playing.
Okay.
So I was already using clones instead of the real original deal. and so it was basically just the changes that need to be play-tested. And the development cycle from the beginning of winter 2009 until it was published in July 2010, the first box, I mean... I was playing just about every week,
okay.
And using the new rules. And when something new comes in, you throw it into the game and see how it works. And when you're dealing with such a familiar framework and you've been playing for over 25 years, I mean, the things still need to be play-tested, but it's I find the things that I need to test out the most are the wording and the explanations more than worrying about if the mechanics are actually working as intended.
Okay. I've got to say, the text you do have in there, especially for like the spells, really makes people rethink those.
Yeah.
Well. And it really gives more inspiration, as far as I'm concerned. You say something works this way instead of the usual blurb you get. And I look and I go, oh, wow, yeah, I could use it like this and this. So, yeah, the text is, like, really good, which I really like.
Yeah, that's one of my problems with the classic game. When you first encounter it, I guess it doesn't matter if, you know, you're 9 years old or in your 20s. Uh-huh. When you first see the text, when you first see Dungeons & Dragons,
right.
It blows you away, start to finish.
Right.
But 25 years on, it's hard to keep that wonder. So rewriting a lot of that stuff and giving it a new flavor, I mean, honestly, mechanically, a lot of them still do the same sort of things as they've always traditionally done. But you just reskin it, and, yeah, it sparks the imagination. It makes
it
you
does.
Think, hey, this is cool. And... Yeah, that was one of the goals there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, let's... here's a couple things I wanted to touch on. Weird fantasy as opposed to high or low fantasy. I saw what you were trying to do in the book. You were trying to give a tone to it that was not your normal adventurers go out, kill the monster, get the treasure, come back. Which was just good, because I like character development and things like that. At the same time, I notice it kind of off-puts some people, because somebody, I think it was on RPGNet, they were talking about Lamentations, and one guy goes, oh, okay, nihilistic, anti-fun RPG. No, thank you. And I looked at that and I go, you know, you're only half right. I see the nihilistic part, but I don't see the anti-fun part. Because to me, a little bit of nihilism can, you know, really spice it up.
Yeah. Well, to me, weird fantasy is a code word meaning horror, but you're still, you know, having adventures. This isn't
right.
This isn't a horror game where it's just all about being a victim or just about. It's not a Call of Cthulhu thing where the whole thing just seems like a suicide mission from the start. You know, it's still about exploration. It's still, you know, there's still treasure hunting in there.
Right.
But I came to think, and I think this is, I came to think of, you know, traditional role-playing as sort of a horror game in itself, because all of the re-examining of the game over the past few years and the blogs and the message boards and the understanding that people have of it now that maybe they didn't have during the heyday of the 80s.
Right.
I started thinking of it as a horror game, you know, low-level characters are disposable. Well, you know, if you are one of those low-level characters, that's a horrifying thing. You know, I don't think the first-level characters are nobodies compared to, you know, a farmer, but you still have these inexperienced adventurers, you know, cobbling together what equipment they have, going into a hole in the ground to fight unknown monsters. That's a terrifying situation.
I always thought it was weird that the game expected, like, first-level characters to have, like, the steel nerves of a combat vet on first level.
Yeah. Well, you could say that, you know, the difference between a first-level fighter and the rank-and-file soldier is that little bit of experience.
True.
I mean,
true.
Now, I don't have much of a problem with that, because you don't have much of a game if you're expecting characters to go into these holes and fight monsters if they're always being forced to run away, if they had to make morale checks, too.
Right. Right. Now, you have the races and classes and races class, which, to me, doesn't really bother me. But why demi-humans at all? The only reason I ask this is because I read something you wrote somewhere else. I think it was on Dragon's Foot about why shouldn't it be all humans?
Yeah. That's a bit of a touchy thing because, in one hand, I really don't use demi-humans as part of the societies in my campaign world. You know, the elves don't live with the humans. When they're used, they're segregated. And really, the game could do without the demi-humans altogether. And maybe it would be a stronger game for it. I'm not sure. But then I'm very much into having very simple character generation, and that means the classes, without a lot of customization.
Right.
And just having four options for a character class, to me, that doesn't seem like enough, but I don't want to start adding all this other junk in just to pad out the things, just to pad out the options. The demi-humans, while they might not necessarily fit, they are helpful for two reasons. First reason is that it is tradition. It helps compatibility. I mean, I want Lamentations of the Flame Princess to mean something on its own within the greater old school thing, but it's not intended to be a complete break from it either. I want people to be able to use adventures that other people, you know, publish with my game, and I want people to be able to use my adventures with another game, you know, if that's what people want to do. And if you screw around with the expectations and the options too much, that becomes impossible. The other thing is, I'm not completely done with the demi-humans myself. I don't know if you've seen any of the adventures I've done.
No, I have not, unfortunately. I read the sample one in here, but that's about it.
You know, the last two standalone, two of the three of the last standalone adventures that I released, one of them is all about dwarves and the secret history of the dwarves.
Mm.
The other one has a twist on elves. And, you know, they're not part of human society. They're, you know, you can have a completely human campaign world and still throw these in, and these just knock you for a loop. But I, you know, that those kind of ideas and adventures become really difficult to implement if your core rules, you know, ignore their existence, if they don't exist in the rules, but here they are in adventures.
Yeah, I think you have a problem right away if you say, oh, these races are just NPCs. You can't play them. Because you know somebody out there is going to go, well, why not?
Yeah. I mean, if you feel that, you know, the demi-human classes don't fit your vision for weird fantasy role-playing, two things you can do. One is disallow them. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. You know, they just take up, you know, what, 4 or 5 pages, maybe 6 pages, I think, total, in all the rule books, things about demi-humans. Just ignore those 6 pages. Or I'm playing in a campaign right now, and the guy who's running the game has decided that the demi-humans don't exist as demi-humans. They're actually different human, well, sub-races, if you will. You know, the dwarf is basically a Scottish Highlander. The halfling is something similar like that. And then the elf is just, you know, it's just a human who fights well and does magic. But you use the exact same, you know, game mechanics and stats, and it's that easy. And suddenly, boom, no demi-humans in your campaign.
Yeah, well, then you got them and you don't got them at the same time.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Okay, well, that makes sense. I don't know why I want this. This is a personal. This is my curmudgeon coming out.
Okay.
But one of the first.
Please do challenge me. It's there.
Okay. Well, no. The only. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Hello?
No, it's just I've done a bunch of these interviews, and some of them are afraid to do any criticism, and it's just not fun when it's just either praise or politeness. You know, I got no problem if you want to challenge me here.
Well, it's not that it's you know, to me it's just petty on my part. I said I almost wanted to put this down and not read it because you did Ascending Armor class. I was wondering how, but, well, see, the thing is, I know 3.5 went ascending, but I said, when I went back to basic, it's going to be descending armor class from now on for everything. No, no more ascending armor class. Don't confuse me. But I was just wondering why you chose the ascending armor class.
I think I had never touched ascending armor class until I started using the basic fantasy role-playing rules back in 2007, I think I started with those. And, you know, the people I was playing with, a lot of them have never played the classic versions of D&D at all. They weren't familiar with Descending Armor class. And frankly, they weren't going to sit there and look up stuff on charts. I had no interest in hunting down things on charts. Ascending Armor class, it's the same mechanic. You just roll the D20 to hit. And instead of worrying about charts and everything, the die roll is the result. It is the armor class. It's so simple and easy. You don't have to explain it to anyone. You don't have.
Okay.
It's just a lot less bother.
I'm going to have to get with you afterwards and find out how you do that, because I usually have a formula in my head for both of that. That was the other problem, because I had the reformer for descending armor class down. Okay, I roll this, I add this, I hit that armor class. Now it's ascending. Now I got to change it around. Great.
Well, I just figure that I don't want to have to worry about whether the players, you know, whether the PCs hit or not. That's the player's job to tell me.
Right.
I do something that's not very old school. When someone is in combat and decides to attack, I figure they know how hard the enemy is to hit. So I tell them they're armor class 18, and so they'll tell me if they hit or not. I don't have to worry about that.
Well, yeah, I want a game with you. I want to get, you're that rare DM who will actually tell somebody the opponent's armor class. That's why I had the whole formula in my head, because 9 times I said, what's his armor class? You don't know. Oh, well, okay, fine. Because, you know, in about 2 hits I'll figure it out anyway. Why don't you tell me now? That kind of thing. But what else do we have here? One of the things that really kind of attracted me, I mean, there's goods and bads in this. One of the things that really kind of attracted me was I found out there were different flavors of weird fantasy and different ways you can go and accept it without, you know, just, oh, yeah, everything's bad and we're going to die and all that kind of stuff. But I was looking on the web, I think it was RPGNet, Jack Shear started doing, like, okay, here's some ideas for a different campaign that's weird fantasy, but they're not the same. And he actually put out a PDF of it called Flavors of Fantasy.
Yeah. That's That's actually one of the things that make me think that I'm successful with what I'm doing here, because what I've done has inspired that. You know, I've got a, you know, there's already been a third party release, you know, with a commercial module based on these rules. Mm-hmm. And to me, the fact that someone is being inspired to do something a little bit different than what's been coming out for Labyrinth Lord and Swords and Wizardry and stuff, that makes me think that there are people that are getting it and there is something genuine to get. I haven't just released something that's the same old with a new skin. There is some substance to it, and
right.
You know, that's a big relief, actually, because
yeah.
You know, whatever your intentions are, you don't know whether you've succeeded until it gets out in the world.
See, if I have criticisms of this system, I don't have very many, because most of the stuff that you changed, I kind of understand why you did it, and some of it is just like nitpicking from the players. Like when you took out Turing Undead, okay, he's just trying to emphasize it's a harder world. And it's a spell, not a given ability for clerics.
And so more importantly, make sure there's actually an important choice for clerics to make when choosing their spell. Otherwise, first and second level clerics, they're just loading up on the Cure Light Wound spell. That's right. My experience. There is no good choice besides that.
And it also the party cannot lean on them as a healer as much if they have to also turn undead. Gotcha.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, things like that, like no resurrection, you know, when you're dead, boom, make another character. Okay. I can hang with that, you know. But some people are just going to, no, that's too far away. So, okay, fine. You know, you can't raise him. Big deal. Go get his brother. You know? Something like that.
Bob the Fighter the Third.
Yes. And not putting monsters out, I think, was an interesting move. Anybody, you know, I've heard people complaining, oh, you didn't put any monsters out for him. He wants you to make them all yourself. Says, well, you could do that or just grab a monster manual somewhere. You know, it'll all work the same, won't it?
Yeah, but I think if you just grab the monster manual, then I think that's missing the point and defeating the point a little bit. I mean, of course, once you've got the game, it's yours, whoever, what the hell you want with it. But, you know, I have intentions in how I want people to perceive it. And, you know, I don't know if this sounds egotistical, you know, but it hurts a little bit when people just grab the monster manual from, you know, or the monster list from another game and just start populating it like it's, you know, play the exact same way they have since 1980. It's not exactly the point of doing this whole new thing.
Right. Well, I put that out there mainly not to take away any of that, but to, as they said on DF, quell the whiners.
Yeah.
All right, fine. You want a bunch of monsters, go get the monster manual. Yeah. That's basically what I'm saying.
Well, my viewpoint is don't have a bunch of monsters. Use less monsters more effectively. You know, if you're just coming up with, you know, maybe one unique creature in the adventure, everything else that you'll fight is, you know, either a human or, you know, a mundane, you know, real-world kind of animal. Mm-hmm. With just one special weird thing, I think you can make that one special weird thing really effective if you set it up right. And I think if you decide to have one monster this time, that creates motivation and inspiration to set it up right. Whereas if you do have the monster book, you know, you're sitting there in the adventure and you almost feel compelled. I'll put three of these here and two of these will go over here. And you're getting that safari kind of thing, which, you know, I want to make clear, I'm not trying to disparage, you know, the traditional way of doing fantasy. I've just decided to go with a different direction with my work and my play.
Okay, understood. And I think the sample adventure in that really bears that out. I do have some problems with the sample adventure, but that, like I said, that's just me. It came off a little too X-Files. Okay, well, they stopped them for now, the changelings. I expect at the end to see the end, question mark. But I do love some of the writing in there. Like, you go to the barn, you go to the Lord, and you find 16 horses. What?
Yeah.
Some of these changelings aren't very bright, are they?
Yeah, but that freaks the players out. I mean,
Yeah, and that's a good example of what you're talking about, monsters, making the monsters unique to the scenario.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everybody's, oh, they're doppelgangers. No, not really. You know, they do nastier things than doppelgangers, so.
Yeah, and there's the changeling mechanic, if you will, mm-hmm. that you don't find out, you know, if this thing copies one of the player characters, you don't find out which one you've killed until after you've killed it and, you know, done the secret, you know.
Yeah, let's open him up to see if he's got a jewel in his chest.
Yeah, and then you find out, no, he doesn't. Oops, sorry, Mike.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. We'll take you to the Temple of Resurrection. Oops, I can't do that here, can I?
But that's, I think, that also gets the horrific atmosphere across, because it's not only, you know, the possibility of killing one of your fellow, you know, player characters by accident. Mm-hmm. It's almost an encouragement to just start going around and opening people up just to see if they've got treasure in them.
Yes.
And you get the player with the wrong mindset, or maybe the right mindset, depending on the group, you know, that adventure turns into a wholesale massacre of innocents.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
And I haven't heard of this happening where it turns into an accidental massacre of innocents, but I'm waiting for that play report where the player characters opened everyone up expecting them to be changelings. But none of them were. You know, I'm just waiting for that play report.
That's
to come
almost
in.
That always comes off as like a satire of looting the body in a regular D&D game.
Yeah.
That's the way it comes off. It really, speaking of mass destruction, let's talk about the art.
Okay.
You've got a lot of artists working on here, and the artwork is just like, it's fantastic. Between like, you know, this one and Vornheim, I'm just having like a conniption fit of wonderfulness here.
Nice.
And yeah, I'm real articulate too.
Yeah.
How'd you get hold of some of these people?
Well, getting a hold of them really isn't difficult. You know, if you have a little bit of money to spend, you just contact the artists on their websites, and you know, if you can make a deal, agree on a price, then you've got yourself an artist. You know, that's the condensed, simple version. Of course, there's always artists you tried to get but couldn't agree on a price, the ones that don't get back to you, the ones that you start working with, they send you, you know, prelim sketches, and then you never hear from them again.
Yes.
But I think I got quite a solid crew for, you know, for the Grindhouse edition here. Vornheim, that was all Zach. That's his book, you know, inside and out. So that, you know, the art came with the writing, basically.
Did he do any artwork for the main Lamentation set?
No. The thing with Zach, because he does art as his main day job, and it's all stuff that he wants to do, you know, he's made this clear. I hope I'm not misrepresenting what he said, but basically he wants to do what he wants to do. And as I understand it, I've never tried to work with him on anything that wasn't his book, because my impression is that his artwork is going to be take it or leave it. And that would drive me nuts. You know, it's okay on his book because that's his book. He knows exactly what it should look like. And to me, when the same guy's writing is doing the art, you know, it lives there. You know, he knows what Vornheim's supposed to look like more than anyone else on Earth, you know?
Right.
But I know what the Grindhouse edition is supposed to look like. And if someone delivers something that is completely against my vision, then, you know, I'm going to tell them, you have to do that over again. And, you know, role-playing artists, for the most part, It's like role-playing writers. The pay scale for doing game stuff, it's pretty low. And I'm a small publisher. I pay what I can. You know, the art bill for the Grindhouse edition came up to about 4,000 or 5,000 euros. So the pay scale is low, but you know, some people made out pretty well from all the artwork they did. And then, of course, I had some, you know, quote unquote celebrity artists like Vince Locke.
Yeah,
so you know, those
really
are.
Nice.
Yeah.
The reason I asked about Zach is because some of the artwork reminded me of some of his stuff in the other book. That's
oh,
the
which
only
pieces?
Reason I asked. Mainly just like the, you know, the front plates of like, say, I'm looking through the Rules and Magic book right now. Mm-hmm. Just like the front piece stuff, like the one in front of Clerics and the one that runs through the book with the monoliths and things like that. With the priest.
Yeah.
It reminds me very much of his style. And that's why I asked. But the other stuff is really beautiful. I just came across one here. Page 127 of a, looks like a giant fighting a dragon with some poor woman in the middle of it.
There's a story behind that one.
That's beautiful.
That piece of art is 7 or 8 years old.
Is it?
Yes. I tried writing my own role-playing game, 2002, 2003, or whatever. And the idea is they were going to be really cheap pamphlets. And I had hired a guy, Dan Berger, to do 3 pieces of art. You know, I was going to have 3 booklets in the set. It was only going to be like $10 for the 3 booklets. Really cheap printing and everything. But this was going to be the cover of the monster book. And then there was also a magic book and the main rule book. The main rule book's cover got used on page 64 of this Rules and Magic book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I noticed it's the same guy that did those. But yeah, of course, I commissioned this artwork and then never got the game done. I got so far as to have a draft of the rules that I was sending out to some people for playtesting purposes. The problem is, I wanted to play basically something like I've made now, except then there was no clue about the open game license. I hadn't hooked back into old edition Dungeons and Dragons communities on the internet, so basically I was trying to make this GURPS skill point system thing that felt like old D&D.
Right.
And I think maybe it was functional, but it's. I'm glad it never got off the ground. Let's put it that way.
Well,
it
was a good attempt. I'm sorry about the. You know, I'm sorry it didn't get off the ground because I mean, as far as like publishing, the concept to me is really good. As far as like making it like pamphlets and that kind of thing, because that kind of thing will sell. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you give me a role-playing game, it's like $10 for a book. Yeah, I'll buy it. Sure. Seeing people dropping 50 or more bucks for, like, whatever edition D&D they want, it's kind of refreshing, actually. But like I said, the art, this is beautiful. This is, and I just thumb through these books, and I just go, wow. And I'm not put off by, the rather lurid adult nature of the stuff either. It's because, I handed this to my wife. She goes, oh my God. And just, yeah, but look at the line. Look at that. Do I have to? Yeah, look. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. Fine, honey. Take it away. Okay.
Yeah. Well, for example, the picture on page 73, the fertility goddess picture.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. Yes.
Yeah, that, I knew that was right, that we'd gotten the tone right. When I showed it to my wife, she's like, you can't print that. You can't put that in your book. I was like, yes, this is exactly what we need. It's a couple reasons for making that sort of artwork. Number one, standards of some people are just way, way too prudish. The whole satanic panic of the 80s with D&D and, oh, my God, this is horrible, and I find it ridiculous that people retreated from that. That mentality is still there, that, oh my God, if we cross this line, then it's going to be the bad times again.
Right.
And I think that that sort of mentality should be challenged, not appeased. And then I'm in Finland. Last night on television was the movie Road Trip. Familiar right. with that one?
Not only by the name.
Okay, well, it's one of those, you know, college sex yeah. comedy things. And it was on primetime, completely unedited, you know, full frontal nudity. The jokes were, you know, the guy's getting the prostate massage at mm-hmm. the sperm clinic, sperm bank. Yeah. You know, this is on primetime broadcast TV in Finland. And I'd somehow like this society hasn't, you know, fallen apart. So I just think people are a bit too prudish in general. And so I just want to do something where I'm not making any compromises, thinking, oh, well, I mean, I'm hoping to get retail distribution in the States. And, you know, the right. cover of the box has, you know, the snake demon topless. You know, I, on one hand, it's self-defeating because there are going to be plenty of places that will not touch it. On the other right. hand, you know, maybe somebody will appreciate that, you know, this guy's going all the way.
Yeah, there's always going to be a place for something like this somewhere. And, you know, if you've got kids, you don't want to show, you know, you don't, oh, my God, we're going to have, you know, kids and stuff. Well, don't show it to them. Don't let them play it, okay?
It's got the 18-plus age warning on the cover. Yeah. Or on the back of the box. It's got the, you know, that yeah. warning anywhere you can buy it on the web.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think everything needs to be safe for kids. And, you know, honestly, I like, you know, really nasty horror movies. I used to be a huge death metal fan in the mm-hmm. early 90s. And, you know, if those things can have some really gross imagery, so can I. I mean,
well, I was just hoping. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, when you play these games, what happens when your character hits 0 hit points? Now, if you're just playing a friendly game and ha ha ha, then a 0, oh God, he's dead, oh no.
Right.
But if you're in the world, think of the game world as a real place. And you're there, and you see the guy next to you get brought down to 0 hit points. You know, that's not going to be clean.
No.
You know, if it's really happening and someone gets, you know, chopped with an axe or, you know, hit with a magic spell, that's going to be nasty looking. It's going to freak you out. So I just, by showing some of that, I think, it achieves some of the effect, like the picture of the woman getting eaten by a slime. You know, people say that looks nasty. It's supposed to.
Yeah, I tend to like hop over the fence back and forth on this. Because on one hand, I don't like a whole steady diet of this, but on the other hand, I can see it and go, hey, that is good. You know?
Yeah, well, the whole thing is, I mean, the whole thing's not a horror freak show. I mean, the cover of the Rules of Magic book, you know, that's, mm-hmm. people have told me that that's the most impressive piece of art in the whole thing, and I can agree with it, and it's got, you know, a wounded guy in the background, but otherwise, that's, I mean, you could show
Oh, my God, Captain John Smith has been killed.
Yes. You know, yes, there's only...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I said, I'm just going to say it's gorgeous. There's a story. I look at it and I go, there's a story behind this picture. There's a game behind this picture.
Yeah.
You know, if it, you know, inspiration. It's great. Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's only two pieces that I think may cross the line. And it's that page spread, what was it, page 72 and 73. The Vince Locke picture on the left in color. And on the right side, it's got that fertility goddess thing. The Vince Locke thing is supposed to be just nasty. And when you take a close look, and you see what's happening, you think, oh, that's just not right.
Right.
I mean, originally, you know, Vince Locke is the guy that, you know, he started an underground horror comics in the 80s. He got famous from the Cannibal Corpse album covers that ended up getting the band, you know, banned various places around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I originally wanted him to get me arrested, do something that's so nasty that, you know, cops are going to come after me. I'm thinking, you know, when the Dead Kennedys had Giger's you know, Penis Landscape in their album. Mm-hmm. There was obscenity charges on that. Unfortunately, you know, while some people look at this and think it has gone that far, I don't think it does because you know, we made a conscious decision to dial it back because I wanted something that makes sense for the game world, you know, for the world that the game takes place in.
Oh, yeah.
So we couldn't do something that's just over-the-top shocking because it doesn't make sense. What is there is plenty nasty, and I haven't even heard anyone, you know, find the Easter egg that's in that picture. But it's plenty nasty.
Oh, now you got me looking. Fine, thank
you. Oh, yeah, look closely. And it's, you know, the first thing you think that you're like, oh, that's not supposed to be an Easter egg. That's supposed to be plainly visible, so look deeper. But, you know, that's plenty nasty, but it's something that could happen in the game. You know, the tomb raiding gone bad.
You know, that'd be a good slogan for your game. Lamentations of the Flame Princess. Look deeper.
Yes. And then on the facing page, you've got the fertility goddess thing, and that is so ridiculous and over the top, even though it is just wrong. It's wrong in a humorous way. There's no way you can look at this one and take it seriously.
This is the kind of thing the Call of Cthulhu game wishes they could get away with.
Well, why can't they get away with it?
Because it's Chaosium, and you know, and
yeah.
Greg.
And then
I'm just guessing. So anyway.
Yeah, the only other one that might be skirting the line is the Medusa sex scene.
I like that because that's one of those ones where it you can go. You have to look at it for a minute and go, oh. Okay, those are snakes. Okay, yeah. I understand it. Well, she doesn't have to. She's not lacking for sex toys. But
now these color pictures, they printed a little bit darker than intended. But when you buy the print version, you get the PDF version. You know, so you can see it just a little bit more clearly, and you can zoom in a little more. You just said about she's not lacking for sex toys, that's part of the picture. But I like, you know, I like promoing this one by saying, so, you know, is this necrophilia or masturbation? You know, is he kind of a dead guy or a statue?
It's a good question. Now, I want to comment on the one facing it. That going through the swamp here.
Yes.
To me, that looks like a seminal picture of weird fantasy. That's when I'm thinking of weird fantasy. That's one of the things I'm thinking of right there. That kind of scene.
Yeah. Now
they're adventuring, but it's spooky. They're in a swamp. They don't know what the hell's going on. Anything can come out of the water and get them or drop down or whatever.
Yeah. I thought that was amazing. I was so worried about this picture. I don't know why. As it turns out, Jason Ranville is an excellent artist. But I was so worried because I wanted the water to come across as oily. And, you know, he got that shine, that, you know, rainbow shimmer that oily water has. He hit that perfect. And then the green light below the water. I mean,
that's really
he
nice.
Nailed that.
But like I said, the whole artwork thing in here is just beautiful. I mean, you've got similar but different styles. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Especially in the, I mean, I geek out over the black and white because I do black and white line artwork. I love looking at black and white line artwork, especially if it's like simple and direct, like the two guys at the door, the guy with the crossbow in his mouth. You know, that simple, direct.
That one was completely Amos's idea. You know, he had the little chapter on finance that needed some art at the bottom of one of the pages. He's like, yeah, how about a guy that's gone broke and, you know, he's going to commit suicide like a stockbroker. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Okay.
The one that really took me aback when you put in the encounter section where you're showing examples of fencing, and boom! Touché! Boom, she's dead.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Now that she's dead isn't even the brutal one. It's the next one where he's pulling the sword out. That's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't expect that. You know, you just think they're going to go through some motions. Boom, 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 boom. Thank you very much. You know, and then a bah! Oh, my God.
Yeah, like in the first, that was just one picture. And I just told Amos, you know, let's make that a series.
Yeah,
and I ended up doing that with several things here because the project took so long to come together that while I was waiting on some people to do stuff, I was like, I got to do some more stuff here. So, and the rules in Magic, that's how the rotting head sequence happens in the headers. And did you notice that? The heads rot as you turn the pages?
I noticed that in every book you got that. Something.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for flip books anyway. So I start doing it, and I'll notice, you know, hey, this eye is moving on this page.
Yeah, yeah. The summoning in the magic section, I am surprised. I didn't think we could pull it off, but that page 163, the last page of the spell descriptions, when the thing that he's summoning arrives,
holy moly, I didn't even catch that the first time. I just thought that was like, okay, he's just doing something fancy for the end of the section. You're right. It matches. Well, sort of. Yeah. Well, no, there he is getting torn in half. Yeah, it matches.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it was like there was nothing. It just kept going, same thing, same thing, same thing. Boom! Whoa.
Yeah. So some of that, some of it is just, you know, something to notice when you're reading the book a couple times and you go, wait a minute.
Just glorious, though. Just glorious. And what else? Oh, do you have any follow-up products coming out? Something on the horizon, maybe?
Yes, that's the one thing about being a one-man shop, is everything takes forever. A lot longer than you feel it should, a lot longer than you planned.
I hear you.
We've got two hardcovers in the works right now.
Really?
We're re-releasing Carcosa and
giving that
just a huge deluxe treatment. Right now it looks like it's going to be around a 300-page book that's going to have this special cover material. It's not leather, but it feels like soft sealskin, the material. And the cover is going to have the metallic foil embossing for the cover.
I'm looking forward to this. I missed Carcosa the first time.
Yeah.
And people, Carcosa. Okay, I'm waiting for this to come out now.
Yeah, and then we're also releasing something else by the same author, Jeffrey McKinney, The Isle of the Unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, is a particularly ingenious piece of work because he sets up an island, and he's really influenced by the old Judges Guild style module. So it's all set up as just a hex crawl. There are the numbered hexes, and the product is entirely describing this place hex by hex.
I love sandboxes.
But the thing is, it's an island that has a civilization. There are settlements and cities and things, but those are not detailed at all. It's just that they're there, and here's some rumors. So you can have whatever culture is in your campaign. You can drop this island in and just say, well, you know, that's the dominant campaign culture is the one that built those cities. But then everything that's in the wilderness of the island is other. Jeffrey, when he was running that as part of his own game, you know, his assumption was that it was 14th century France that ruled the island, that were in control of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
But the artwork and, you know, the wizards that live out on the island, they've got this Greek and Roman flavor that was, you know, other for the characters in the campaign. So just because this thing might have sort of a Greek look doesn't mean it doesn't fit in your campaign. It's supposed to be strange and anachronistic.
Right.
So that, and we're going all out on that. That's going to be hardcover full color.
Okay, what was that called?
Still, Isle of the Unknown.
Isle of the Unknown, something to look forward to.
Every monster, there's 109 unique monsters in there. Each one's getting an illustration. Each one is just completely new and unique. Every NPC that's out there on the island, you know, none of them use any standard powers. All of them were built from scratch as far as what they can do and what their abilities are. Everything in here is just completely new.
Nice.
And then sometime in the schedule is a re-release of Exquisite Corpses by Stephen Pogue.
Okay.
That's been delayed a little bit because, you know, he's doing everything, the writing and all the art, and he's decided now that some of the art, you know, this was his decision. I was fine with everything he was doing, but he's decided that some of the art wasn't up to snuff, so he's redoing stuff, so I'm not sure when we're going to get around to getting that out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm, of course, writing some of my own new adventures. It's been a while since I've gotten any out. The first one that will be coming is The Monolith from Beyond Space and Time, which is...
Monolith from Beyond Space and Time.
Yeah, this is going to be my Lovecraft adventure, but I had to make sure that none of Lovecraft's trappings were in there. Just like my game looks like traditional fantasy role-playing, except it's got no orcs, no plus one swords, no fireballs, this is going to be a Lovecraft adventure with no Cthulhu, no Necronomicon, you know, none of the usual things you find with someone that wants to make something Lovecraft.
Wait a minute, you said no fireballs?
No fireballs.
No commie? What are you, a communist? Well, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
Those sound like some interesting things coming out.
Yeah,
now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and then the other thing, I just had this idea. I've just started outlining it. I always have this problem. I'm in the middle of finishing another project, and the next one just, you know, it comes alive in my head, and I've already gotten outlines. I've decided, based on the 70s origins of D&D, I wanted to do something to salute that. And I thought of the old Jeff D. artwork where the characters had bell bottoms in the D&D artwork. So I decided I'm going to do a disco-based adventure.
Oh, boy.
And I'm setting it up so if everything goes right, you know, I'm trying to do this without this being a railroad to get there, and it's still in development, and, you know, for all I know, I'm talking all this, and I'm this excited, and it'll never come out because I can't get it to work. But I want the movie, I want the adventure to end in a dance-off in, you know, classic party movie style. You know, the working title I had in my head was The Interpretive Dance of Eric Zahn.
Oh.
And it was just going to feel really disco as far as everything that happens, like the boogie nights of, you know, role-playing adventures or something. And so, somebody involved in the local Lovecraft Society here gave me the perfect title. I had wanted to call it Saturnine Night Fevers.
Uh-huh.
Someone's already done something like that, so I didn't want to use it. So this person came up with the idea of the Dancing Queen in Yellow.
Ooh, I like that. You hit more than one author with that one.
Yes, so hopefully now that I'm talking about it, because I've mentioned it on my blog, I'm excited. Hopefully this comes out before the year 2015 now. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, this is what's going through my head right now, so this is what you're getting.
Now, you had a monster book come out before Lamentations.
Yes.
Basically, build your own. What was it called again?
The Random Esoteric Creature Generator for Classic Fantasy Role-Playing Games and Their Modern Simulacra.
Is that still available?
Yes, that's available from Goodman Games. As of, you know, this conversation, I've got a few copies in my web shop, which, you know, is especially good if you're in Europe.
Yes.
But yeah, that's still you know, an active item in Goodman Games catalog, and I thank them for putting it out there. That was my very first role playing credit, and it got picked up by a company that, you know, gets stuff all over the world. Can't complain about that.
Can't really. Yeah, I heard about that through Grognardia when he did a review of your game, and he was quite disappointed you didn't put a copy of that in the Lamentations.
That's a difficult thing, because I was thinking something along those lines. You know, I've got something like that in the Summon Spell, but that's very specialized. But, you know, the thing with, you know, I gave the rights to release this to Goodman Games in good conscience, you know, in good faith.
Right.
And just because now I have an idea where I could use something like it, it would not be, I don't think it would be good business or, you know,
it
would be dirty pool to undercut it by doing something updated or better because that came out 3 years ago. I've got different ideas on how to present it differently. I could have done that, but not only would that really have been dirty pool dealing with Goodman Games, but I think it would encourage, instead of just getting a standard monster book, just rolling up monsters and still having that lack of thought that I'm trying to avoid for people in Lamentations.
Yeah. Some people want to create, some people just want to stock. That's what I was figuring. So, and these are available, and aside from that one, all these will be, are or will be available on your website?
Yeah, I've got my web store. You know, I appreciate anyone that orders stuff from there, but I also work really hard to get into distribution. Right now, I've just got, you know, limited distribution. You can find me in Noble Knight and Indie Press Revolution and Troll and Toad in the States. But I'm working on some distribution to hopefully get stuff into the more adventurous, you know, brick-and-mortar retailers.
Right. Okay, so get through those venues or yours, and your website is LamentationsOfTheFlameprincess.com? Or
LOTFP.com.
Thank you, LOTFP.com. What's your blog?
LOTFP.blogspot.com.
Okay. Good man, I'm on Blogspot too. Well, anyway, well, thank you for talking to us, James,
no problem.
To me, to all those people out there. And look for these products, and they get a thumbs up from me.
If you have any comments, please email saveordiepodcast@gmail.com or visit saveordie at saveordie.info. Follow the cast on Facebook / Save or Die Podcast, or follow them on Twitter @TheEvilDM.